CliffCentral.com. 4 minutes after seven, it is time for the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. Every single week, we look at all the big current affairs stories. Nando's themselves, I don't know if you saw the ad that's been doing the rounds. These guys, either they made it themselves or it was made by fans, but often they are the most hilarious and opportunistic of people in the marketing universe. They've come up with this brilliant logo, which has been sent around. Well, I suppose you could call it a GIF, a meme, of the saying that finger licking ain't so good, considering the coronavirus. And it's very, very smart. If it is Nando's, congratulations to you guys. Again, ahead of the curve. And some people saying, oh, well, that's very mean of you to do that to your competitors. But actually, it's very, very clever. And most people in the market probably appreciate a sense of humor at this stage because there's so much dire news. So I'm joined this morning by Canton Pillay, our returning champion, but I'm also joined by Mo Sheikh, someone I've been trying to get into the studio for a long time. Mo, you had to write a book before I could actually get you in here.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, it's unacceptable, actually. Yeah. I did see you not so long ago,
yeah.
And I was excited to hear about this book coming out. It really is incredible. We're going to get to your thoughts on what's going on in the world at the moment, and maybe between the two of you, Canton and Mo, you have some interesting observations about the way the world's responding to this coronavirus outbreak. Whether or not the two of you've got any personal stockpiles of loo paper, we'll find out what the situation is of loo paper in both your houses.
You understand that my tribe has a history of actually washing our rear ends.
Then what I want to know is all the details, and we'll get to that in a little while. But before that, I do want to refer to your book because it would be remiss of me to not do so, and it's full of interesting stories. I only have read part of it, but I'm already knee deep. It's your story.
Yes.
And it's difficult to write something autobiographical, especially when you've been in intelligence, because there's still things that you can't say.
Well, yes, that is true. And if you notice that the book is a fine balance between what I thought I needed to get off my chest and what I needed to say, yeah, and what I could say. And it's a fine line, and I was wondering whether I would get a call from the Inspector General of Intelligence about whether I should say certain things. There's one particular thing I've written there which I suspect, if they are capable enough, they would pick it up. But so far, no one has.
It got through the cracks.
It got through the cracks, Canton. Cracks.
But you didn't. You didn't have to. You didn't have to pass this by anybody.
No, I made a very deliberate decision not to do that.
Mo, how does it work when you leave intelligence? Do you still have to? Are you still a person of interest to them? Do they still monitor what you're up to, or are you just expected to do, you know, the honorable thing and keep shtum about stuff that you know that probably you're one of maybe a handful of people in the country who know, during a time where, you know, there were enemies at the gates politically. We have factions now in the ANC who are battling for information and power, and anything that you know could be used for or against you.
Gareth, that's a fantastic question. There's a protocol that governs ex-head of intelligence services and intelligence officers as a whole. And there is the Protection of Information Act, where you cannot disclose, or without authority you cannot disclose information. Mm-hmm. Constitutionally, there's a fine balance between what's in the public interest and what is in the interest of the state. And the courts have always ruled that if the matter is in the public interest, then permission is given to release any state secret.
Which is different from many other parts of the world.
Which is very different. And I remember when we were drafting the Constitution, we specifically put that clause in about we've got to find the balance between national security and the public interest. But more importantly, there is a protocol that exists amongst the intelligence officers that, yes, you would come into across in the duration of your work with lots of secrets. Mm. And it is in the interest of the profession that those secrets remain secrets. We don't have a classification period, which is perhaps one of the weaknesses that we have. where if after a certain period of classification, such information can be made public.
How hard is it for a person who's been as enmeshed in the political system? I mean, here you are talking about the Constitution, and your family have been involved in the ANC and in the struggle for since before there was a Constitution. Is it hard to become a normal private citizen and to realize that you that everything isn't politics after you've been in a world where everything is?
Yes, the wonderful thing about that is to have children. And children remind you that life is not only about politics. It's mainly about love, it's about growing up, it's about sharing little joys and little things. And imagine my difficulty of having to explain to my children what apartheid was like. And here's the thing, I'm married to a Canadian woman who happens to be Caucasian, and I have a son who looks very much Caucasian. I have a daughter.
It happens in these mixed families. Sometimes one kid doesn't look like the other.
And I have a daughter who looks very much like me.
Okay.
At best, classified Cape Coloured in old apartheid.
But in the old days, what you're saying is that if they were those apartheid race profiling people around, they would have separated your family on various lines.
Absolutely. Oh. Now, imagine every time I go pick up my son from school, where I'm very mindful that I could not attend a school as a person of color, but yet my son could. But the positive side of it is that here's this guy, blonde hair, blue eyes, that one day would be able to stand up in the country when he wants to become president and say, I am previously disadvantaged. But that's going to take the mockery out of black economic empowerment, wouldn't it? Yes.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you bring that up, because obviously, one of the things that I've always wanted to talk to you about, and it's been difficult because of your role in intelligence, for example, where you were actively engaged at the time that I first wanted to interview you. There are also people who would say that what happened post-apartheid is difficult to deal with. There was the Thabo Mbeki camp. There was the Jacob Zuma faction. There was a lot of stuff that we didn't know about that was going on even during the Mandela administration. And people like you knew a lot more than the average person, and some of it you were able to share, and most of it you had to keep to yourself. And now you've written this book. Are there people who called you who were very nervous before they'd seen the manuscript? Highly placed individuals, people of influence, people in political circles, who were nervous that you would say things that might be detrimental to their reputation?
I'm sure there were a lot of people who were nervous, and especially when the title of the book was called ANC Spy Bible, I'm sure there's a lot of people who bought the book wanting to go quickly to the back of the book to see whether their names are listed or whatever. But I was quite deliberate in that this is not going to be a book about spies. It's going to be a book about my memoir. Well, I actually wanted it to be a novel. So, no, I did not receive any phone calls, but I also felt it necessary in the course of writing the book to give particular scripts to individuals named in the book so that they could have an opinion of it. And I must say, from all of the key characters in the book, they were very supportive of the writing, and they encouraged me to go ahead and publish it. So none of them, in fact, exerted any kind of censorship.
We get into your head a little bit. You even have a list of songs at the back of the book that you love.
Yes.
I mean, this to me is really the color of something like this. And you said it's getting stuff off your chest. I like the fact that we get into your life and we get to know you a little bit more, because a lot of people in government seem to us to be these monolithic bureaucrats, especially in intelligence, where you're required not to have too much personality very often. I'd love to know, and maybe we save it for the end of this morning, I'd love to know how it actually works. You know, if there's a red telephone, I want to know whether or not the NIA campus that we've all heard about out near the Rietvlei Dam, is this very technologically advanced place that's gathering information on citizens, and whether or not the machinations and the goings-on of a place like that are as nefarious as most people assume, thanks to the movies, or whether it's something, you know, quite benign, that is trying to execute very basic requirements of the state to gather information on, you know, threats, dangers, realities. We'll get into that maybe a bit later on. And I do want to refer to some of the stories in your book. But gentlemen, there are a lot of people at the moment who are very nervous about what's going on in the world. The markets are reacting very badly. Governments, some of them are reacting, in the opinion of analysts, well, others reacting poorly. We had our president make an unprecedented announcement on Sunday, which has largely been received well by not only the population, but by all the intelligentsia, who often have an influence outweighing their real-world influence. What are your positions on, first of all, President Cyril Ramaphosa's directives around this coronavirus? How do you think the government has handled things? How do you think William Keyser has? What do we need to do that we're not? Give me your status quo. Give me the status briefing you might have given the president, Mo. And Canton, where do you think we are?
I'll let Mo go first.
Okay, no pressure.
So let me do this. This is a 7 a.m. briefing to President Cyril Ramaphosa.
Right.
Mr. President, glad you've given me the time to see you. I want to point out that we are on the verge of a major explosion of the virus, and I would advise that we shut down the country. The measures you have put in place are extraordinary, and I think we may have to scale up these measures if we want to flatten the curve. In which case, President Ramaphosa will say, how do we do that? Well, sir, I'm deeply concerned that when the virus moves into local transmission, we may not be able to contain the outbreaks in the in our townships, in the informal settlements. And therefore, I would really seriously give in consideration to possibly a curfew at a certain time. Gareth, you know that the announcements yesterday of closing bars and restaurants at 6 o'clock is in effect a part of a partial curfew.
Absolutely.
So
these are things that have been gazetted, by the way. They haven't yet been passed into action. The executive can make an order like this, right?
Yes, correct.
So they don't necessarily need Parliament's approval.
They don't. And then he would say, Director, are you suggesting we should engage in scenario planning? And I would say, yes, sir. He will then say, okay, can you please lead that discussion with the National Joint Operation Team and have within my desk by the end of the day various scenarios that will scale up and scale down depending on whether we are flattening the curve or not.
And then the president would choose between those various scenarios and
That's
enact
correct. Yes.
whatever regulations and requirements might be needed to make them effective.
That's correct. And we would give the pluses and the negatives of each scenario. What are the consequences, unintended consequences, and what will be the mitigation to those consequences? So intelligence is effectively a planning tool which is used in times of crisis. Now, here's the thing. This is not the first time that we've dealt with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I remember way back in 1994, there was a big debate whether intelligence should be advising on the possible spread of HIV and the consequences of HIV in our society. And of course, the difference between HIV and corona, HIV is more chronic, and with ARVs can be managed as chronic.
Well, we didn't know that at the time.
We didn't know that at the time. And at that time, there was a fair element of panic in respect of what will be the economic cost.
Well, our infection rates were through the roof.
Exactly.
1994, we had a lot of people who didn't even know. There was a basic ignorance around HIV.
Absolutely
AIDS.
Correct.
Right. There were still debates around whether HIV did lead to acquired immune deficiency syndrome or not. And people thought that it only happened to certain people, which, funnily enough, is happening now with this corona. It's obviously bad information. But there are people who believe, oh, no, this is only affecting rich international travelers.
Correct.
Fact is, what you pointed out earlier, local transmission is our big fear.
And one of the recommendations that I remember made at that time that central to the defeat of HIV spread is education.
Right.
And you can see how engaging and communicative the current government is on educating the South African public about the do's and the don'ts of the coronavirus.
Sure. People are joking about the president doing the elbow greeting and, you know, washing his hands. But these things are important.
Absolutely.
Everywhere in the world. It's not a question of ignorance just in South Africa, but all over the world, this is what leaders are telling their people. So, Canton, based on that briefing from Mo that he might give to the president if he was still the head of national intelligence now, how do you feel the president has responded?
I think the useful thing is that the president was decisive for the first time during his entire term in office. I think every single one of us has been asking for the past couple of years, where is the presidential material in this president? And I think really for the first time, this is where we saw there was no ambiguity whatsoever. He was stepping up to the plate. He was quite decisive in terms of what the steps were that were needed to be taken in terms of taking the country forward. There was no sugarcoating of how serious this actually is. There was no pussyfooting around the economic impact that was going to follow from all of this. In other words, I think that for the first time, the guy stood up to the plate and he acted presidential. And guess what? As a direct result of that, every one of the opposition parties
fell in line.
And they threw in their support because of the fact that they could see that this was actually the way to be going forward.
Because leadership is contagious too.
It is, absolutely.
And we've had a complete dearth of that for the longest time.
Correct. And I think for the longest time, the issue that we've been having with the Ramaphosa presidency, look, let's be quite clear. We know of the fallout that resulted from the Zuma era. But what has frustrated most of us is we want to see action. It doesn't matter how small the action is, but as soon as we see
Standards are pretty low for our expectations of it.
Our expectations are incredibly low. But at the point at which now, for the first time, we're actually seeing proper steps being put in place, if you can get to the stage where the taxi drivers take you seriously, which is what's happening in our country right now, this is a signal moment for our country. We should not downplay just how important this is.
Now, Mo is exactly the kind of person who I was always afraid of in the state architecture, who was trying to or presiding over a chipping away of individual liberties in order to give the state the authority that it needs to enact the kinds of things that we probably need right now. And there is an interesting philosophical debate that we may or may not get into this morning around the idea of people once again and for the first time in a long time having to heed government. I mean, we live in a country where it's indisputable that most people, it's a bit like the Wild West. Most people don't really care what the government say. Most people don't do what the government tells them to do. Most people don't obey the police. They don't pay their e-tolls. Although there is a basic understanding in this crisis that we all need to work together to beat it because we're all vulnerable, I think people are suddenly far more willing to give up whatever they thought were their rights and their liberties before in order to achieve something bigger here. But at what cost? You know, it's kind of like when, you know, terrorism in the United States gets everyone so fired up that they're prepared to be put under surveillance.
Yes.
24/7. Is there something to worry about from that point of view? Canton, you're a libertarian.
I am. And I think the interesting thing, if you look at the social dynamic that's playing itself out right now, by and large, you know, everyone in our country has actually come to the party. If you consider the approach that the Chinese have taken in terms of combating the virus, essentially they're an authoritarian state, and they're able
welded some people into their apartments.
Yes. And you know, it's a complete lockdown. Yes, they built this hospital out of shipping containers in 48 hours, and then they promptly bolt people into it and wait for the dust to settle. We can't do that. We're a democracy, and which to my mind is a very good thing. But at the same time, we've actually shown, apart from a couple of idiots who refuse to slap themselves into quarantine, and and frankly, I think the best way to deal with that type of person is to just actually out them and then let society...
because they're a threat to the rest of us.
They're a threat to the rest of us. They're kind of like anti-vaxxers at that level.
Now, you see, guys, you're already talking like securitocrats. So,
God help us.
So here's the thing.
Are these things you would debate when you were...
Absolutely.
You would think about this, and it wasn't always a fait accompli that what was good for government was good for people.
Well, I must say something though, Mo. If you go back to the beginning of our democracy, and I wrote about this back in 97, you know, because it was around about the time of the State of the Nation address. Of course, at the time it was still the Mandela presidency. And at that time, Joan Clancla was in charge of intelligence. And at that time, intelligence wasn't a separate ministry. It was actually a sub-ministry of the Department of Justice.
Right. Correct.
You know, which again, you know, tells you something interesting about the way in which thinking was taking place at the time, that intelligence wasn't this thing that was running off to the side.
Mm.
But the media at that stage, all of us were invited into the ministry offices, and there was open discussion around all of the stuff, and absolutely unprecedented. It was the kind of thing that has never happened anywhere else in the world, as far as I can tell, which gave you an indication of the type of thinking that was shaping the way in which we wanted our democracy to be functioning back then. I don't know to what extent to this day that still survives within the intelligence community, because Mo's obviously not in that hot seat anymore. But I'd like to think that there are enough people on the ground who actually were in there at the beginning and still have that attitude kind of ingrained.
Yeah. But the great thing about that, Compton, is that Joan Clancla insisted that it be put in the Constitution. And when I look back at his singular intervention, his legacy would be that we have a constitutional chapter that safeguards democracy in our country against the rantings and the prerogatives of the intelligence services.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because it's in the Constitution, we'll always be able to rely on it, and various non-governmental organizations will be able to rely on it when there's a perception that democratic rights have been eroded. But let me just make a point about democratic rights. We do live in the world of surveillance capitalism, mm-hmm. and where the commodity today is behavior surplus. If any of us do not think that that is the case, just take your smartphone
mm-hmm.
and you'll see how your data is given to major international corporations who process that data and who predict your behavior and sell you products based on your predictability. I mean, I love music.
Sure.
So I always listen to YouTube, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one day it popped up in YouTube, "We recommend this song for you." And I thought, my God, how do they make this recommendation to me? But it's an algorithm that they have, sure. right? So it's algorithms that are generating and starting to predict our behavior. So in many ways, we already live in an era in which, unbeknown to us, the data that we are putting on our smartphones is being analyzed by someone who has access to it.
But Mo, there's an element to that that's voluntary. And this is the big difference. And also what that information may be used for. Nefarious as it may be that they suddenly suggest songs to you, it doesn't necessarily harm your privacy or your ability to make decisions, or you get used against you. What we do see in some intelligence services all over the world, and this is really the question that I've been burning to ask you, is when we have a surveillance state, it's a very different thing to where you opt in to using social media, for example, because what that information could be used for is sometimes a lot more dangerous than the info that an advertiser might have. If the state knows that someone has, for example, information which compromises someone else, that could be used in a very nefarious, insidious way to harm that person. And we've seen, you know, during the whole spy tapes drama mm-hmm. with Jacob Zuma, mm-hmm. that people will use information gathered, sometimes the right way and sometimes the wrong way, for political purposes, and that's never good.
Sure, that's never good.
So how much do you guys know, I mean, when you say you guys, when you were at NIA, how much did you know about ordinary citizens, and how much did things like FICA allow you to delve into people's private information?
You know, we live now in the time of integrated databases. And everything you put out there in the electronic world leaves a footprint.
Sure.
And that footprint or fingerprint is very necessary when there is an investigation. But there are protocols that govern all of this. For example, the National Intelligence Agency, or now known as the State Security Agency, would require a judicial approval before it intercepts or has access to data, and that includes even putting you under surveillance or bugging your house or etc. So yes, the technology exists, and we do have the technology for very pervasive penetration of one's privacy and communications.
What kind of rules need to be followed in order for intelligence people in this country to gather that information on an ordinary member of the public?
There's a dedicated judge who the intelligence services have to apply to, and they have to make the case before a judge. And the judge would look at it and then either make the determination that, no, I don't believe the evidence you're putting before me justifies an interception, or he may stipulate the conditions around the interception. You may only intercept for a month or not more than that. So there are those protocols. Of course, the issue is this. All intelligence services, and this is why it is also in the Constitution, that our intelligence services have to be trained in understanding the law. All law, international law, and all customary law and all legislation that governs this. And part of that is we believe that by educating people about the law, there will be an element of self-regulation. Mm-hmm. So you see the idea of self-isolation, self-regulation would have happened.
Because you come from a background, why I'm asking you this more than any other intelligent operative, and we haven't got the head of the current NIA in here because I don't think he can say very much, but you used to do things like procure arms during the struggle. I mean, you guys were involved in lots of things which they couldn't trace because we didn't have electronic footprints then. You had to be very careful about what you sent in written form. I mean, it was real spy stuff. This is the world that you grew up in.
Yeah.
And for you to have been spied on by that government must have always been lingering in the back of your mind when you were inquiring into the ins and outs of an ordinary citizen post-apartheid, right?
Sure. And this is why there's a part in the book where I say that we debated at a great extent what are the democratic limits that must be placed on the intelligence services, partly because we knew of the illegal things that we were doing.
And the illegal things that the old government was doing to spy on you.
To spy on us. And
sometimes to kill people.
And because of that, we took a position that we must ensure that never again, following on the great call of President Mandela, never again must we go back to that kind of history. And this is why, for me, it really does break my heart when there are violations of the intelligence services. And I do make the point in the book that when our intelligence services started to serve the narrow insecurities of a president rather than serving the people, which is what is required with the Constitution, that is when the beginning of the fallout between myself and President Zuma took place.
Well, he very publicly also turned his back on your brother, and there were a number of other things that must have exacerbated that, which couldn't have made it easy for any of you. And people like to see history in terms of villains and heroes.
Sure.
And I think in some ways, there are probably stories that you haven't yet told that you might save for a second book. I mean, around exactly this, where people have said, well, there's you and there's, you know, there's Yunus and there's Shabir and Chippy, and you guys have got a reputation as a family, some earned, some unearned.
Yeah.
And people like to say, well, that's a good guy, that's a bad guy, and sometimes that's not very fair.
Sure. And Gareth, I just want to make
that
point.
For your kids, it's not very fair.
We moved away from, in the old days, way, way back in feudal times, a crime of one person in the family was visited on the entire family.
Right. Pogroms, essentially.
Right, exactly. And one of the beauties of living in a democracy is that each of us are held accountable for your individual actions. actions.
Absolutely.
So the crimes of Shabir Sheikh are Shabir Sheikh's crimes. They're not the crimes of the Sheikh family.
I know.
But living in the country like we do, with all its prejudices, biases, and stereotypes, we have had to accept that, you know, the family often was considered as a collective entity. And in part, maybe we conducted ourselves as a collective entity in demonstrating human solidarity to our brother who was going through a hard time. But we have individual lives, and we try to live those individual lives.
Was there pressure for you to talk more about that in the book, or did you have no pressure whatsoever? You just wrote your story as you wished it to be written.
Yes, the book is deliberately thin on Shabir Sheikh's story, and where it intersects with my life, I put it down.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very deliberate decision I took as the author, because in fact, Shabir Sheikh must tell his own story. This is my story. And the good thing is, I never submitted the text to any of my family members when the book was written. They saw the book when the book was published. And... Ooh. And they had to read what
I'm
they
sure
had to read.
I'm sure there must have been some family dinners that were very uncomfortable.
I think that Shabir's book should be called The Healing Power of Golf.
See, Canton, only you would say that in front of his brother. Now to go ahead in terms of current affairs and where we're at the moment, a lot of people are also laying all the blame for all of our problems at the feet of Jacob Zuma. People like in a time of crisis with what's going on with coronavirus to blame the government or a person or worse, the Chinese. And we're seeing small outbreaks of some pretty revolting racism and xenophobia against Chinese people, not just here but all over the world, which I think is uncalled for. But there is an amount of responsibility that has to be laid at the door of China in the case of what they did to try and contain what they didn't want the world to know about this virus in the beginning. And there are things that we can lay at the feet of this administration and the previous one in this country for how they might deal with it. But a lot of that has to happen with the benefit of hindsight, right?
I think if you consider what went down in terms of China this time, remember that the reason why we got to know about this in the first place was because there was a Chinese doctor who was effectively a whistleblower. Yeah. And that Chinese doctor ended up dying of the virus.
That's right.
And if not for that one person, we might very well have had the scenario where this thing would have spread pretty much untrammeled around the world. Now consider that exactly the same scenario could very likely have emerged in just about any other society.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, consider WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden as a classic example. All of those machinations that the Americans do on a day-to-day basis, again, would probably never see the light of day, if not for the fact that you had the ability for us to make use of the effectively the same tools that are used against us for surveillance to then end up spreading information.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think what we should be alive to or more aware of now is that we are going to enter the era of the blame game.
Yeah.
Who is to blame? And of course, I'm sure you have seen all the conspiracy theories going around that this possibly could be the beginning of a kind of germ warfare. Was it started by the Americans? Was it deliberately started by China? But what we can say is the following, that China is going to recover from this epidemic, pandemic, before the rest of the world, as the epicenter has now moved. So in terms of lead time, I think China would have a 12-month lead time in terms of economic recoveries than the rest of the world will have. And that will shift somewhat some balance of power in a very fragile relationship between China and US in the favor of China, and there will be consequences for that. So I think we are now moving into an area of extreme fragility in the world and in the matrix of the world, as the China-USA tension. And in fact, we should call it what it is.
Trade war.
It is a cold war between China and the US at the moment.
Jockeying for the position
for hegemony. Right. Exactly.
Now, I want to quickly go to something else before we move on to more current affairs, because you were at the Zondo Commission.
I was indeed.
And you were asked to give testimony about what happened during your tenure there as head of the NIA. And you spoke about President Zuma and the international conspiracy that he thought was being built against him. How difficult is it to speak to someone? We've seen throughout history the story of leaders who become convinced that everyone is against them, or that there is some conspiracy against them, even when all the evidence points the other way. They stop trusting the people around them. Sometimes they go crazy. Sometimes they lash out. Sometimes they do really despicable things to society and to the people who they're meant to govern. How hard is it as the intelligence chief to deal with someone who sees boogeymen everywhere?
It's extremely hard. But I just want to go back to some of our history. We owe our democracy to the intelligence services of that time.
And Jacob Zuma was the head of
it. And he was the head of it.
In the ANC.
In the ANC. And so was Neil Barnard. Mm-hmm. So Neil Barnard was the head of the NIS, who had this very difficult discussion with P.W. Botha and said, we need to start talking to the ANC. When that approach was made to the ANC, Jacob Zuma, the head of ANC intelligence, went to his leadership and said, we need to start talking to the other side. So it is in that magic when two intelligent heads on either side came to the conclusion that we need to start talking, that is how our negotiations started.
Right.
Now, it is that I relied upon when I thought, you know, that President Zuma would abide by the dictum of intelligence that we speak truth to power. When he shut the conversation down, and especially in respect to the Guptas, it made it very difficult. And I saw that as the beginning of a demand for what I call conspicuous subservience. And you cannot have conspicuous subservience in the intelligence community, because the intelligence, and especially the relationship between the head of the intelligence service and the president, must be one in which they could have the most difficult and the most crucial conversations, and both sides will be able to respect each other because of that conversation.
How many times a week did you see the president?
Well, not as often as we would like to, but whenever there was a burning national security issue,
there wasn't a regular weekly.
We would have regular, we produce papers,
right,
which is, so the president gets the briefing.
The information, yes.
And when the situation demands, we then press the red button and you would get access to the president.
Now, were you based in an office in Pretoria or Cape Town or both? How did it work?
We have offices all over the country, but the offices of the head of the intelligence services, whether the foreign or domestic, is both in Pretoria and in Cape Town.
Where's your main base of operations?
Pretoria.
And you would have an office, at the NIA campus?
Yes, it's on the NIA campus.
And was it this extremely high-tech office like James Bond's villains always have, with screens in it and multiple telephones and lines of communication in and out?
That's not in your office, but that's in the op center, which is very close to your office.
What is your office? Just a normal desk and a phone?
No, it's a very executive-looking type of office,
right,
with lots of phones.
Right.
But you have access to this operational center with the multi-screens and all of that, because that is also a busy place. And often there's the head of the intelligence service should not be the director of operations, because that should be a task given to someone else. And the head of the intelligence services has to keep an eye on operations, on human resources, on the strategic issues of keeping the service relevant.
You could get anyone's number you needed.
Yes.
And they could call you if they were important enough.
Yes.
And how much of that was solicited and how much of it wasn't? In other words, as the head of intelligence, you might get calls from people you actually don't want to hear from. And there are also, in a society like South Africa, there are some pretty dodgy people who would try to get hold of the head of national intelligence. Your own life might occasionally be at risk.
Yes.
You know things about certain people, crime syndicates,
yes,
businessmen, people of influence who could exert some undue influence,
yes,
if you were a weaker person. These are things you need to guard against. Did
Absolutely.
You have round-the-clock security?
Yes, I had. You have round-the-clock security.
Your family becomes, as well. They need to be
not
safe.
I've got this. I've got this very cheeky Canadian wife. She didn't want to have all of those things.
Okay. She wanted the kids to grow up as normally as possible.
Absolutely. But ideally, what happens is when you're appointed as the head of the intelligence services, you are relocated to, as you said it, the Root Flay. You relocated to a secure complex.
There, right.
And there is accommodation there for the heads of the services. We chose not to live there. We chose to live in our current home. And to maintain as much as possible a normal life. The kids and Aaron were willing to accept that I worked late at night, I would have to travel quite often, but they didn't want me to bring work home in the sense of the bodyguards and the VIP protectors and all the hotlines, etc. And they said, no, we don't want any of that here. We want to keep the house as normal as possible, which is, in fact, fantastic. Because when I was fired, effectively fired,
you didn't
going
miss
back,
any of it.
I didn't miss anything. I didn't have the problem of sitting in the back seat of a car and wondering why the car is not moving.
Would you drive yourself?
You're not allowed to drive yourself. No. Under official duties, but I would ensure that weekends, they could be in another car, but I would, and my wife and I and the kids would drive together. Yeah,
sure.
I didn't want to lose my ability to know how to drive.
Are there any places that even the head of national intelligence is not allowed to just walk into?
Yes, our nuclear facilities. It's very rare that they'll deny you access, but you will be stopped at the gate. So in places where there is absolute need for security, which is outside of the intelligence services, you would not get access to it without prior arrangements. And the key is prior arrangements. And the same is with certain military installations. You won't, as a head of the intelligence service, be able to go in there. You would need the permission of the chief of the SANDF.
I'm sorry, Kenton, you're a bit of a passenger here because I'm asking all the questions I wanted to ask.
I'm just giving Mo enough kind of rope to hang himself.
Thank you.
because I actually want to climb in at this point. There's a couple of flaws in terms of the way in which structurally the country was set up. The biggest flaw, of course, we're aware of, is that it placed too much power directly in the hands of the president, mm-hmm, in terms of the ability to actually make decisions. And the problem that we always had in terms of our intelligence setup was that and Mo is absolutely right, that there's a dedicated judge who is responsible for approving or disapproving of such things. But again, the problem comes when you have all of this power vested in an individual. And what happens when that individual actually goes wrong? And that led to the scenario where the 2017 figures that Right to Know pulled from just from the telcos showed that the law enforcement agencies were spying on 70,000 cell phones. 70,000 cell phones. Now let's be very clear.
But
hang on.
There may be 70,000 criminals in the country.
Very much, at least 70,000.
Here's my problem with this. Okay, in order for a judge to be able to determine the merits or demerits of those 70,000 individual applications, because fundamentally, in terms of our constitutional framework, it needs to be those 70,000 individual applications. And what I'm saying is that the checks and balances at that level were just not in place, because it allowed this ability of people to then issue blanket orders that could then be used for whatever purpose without any proper constitutional oversight, which finally led to the situation where we had RICA being declared to be unconstitutional. Which happened? How long ago was this?
About 2 years now.
I'm just taking a look. No, it was 18th September last year, in fact, that...
the judgment was given.
The judgment was given 18th of September last year, but in fact, the judgment has been... implementation has been stayed to give Parliament a chance to actually...
Fix
this process. Yeah. So what I'm saying is that even though we have this scenario where ostensibly the processes are in place, abuse has continued. And I think the extent of the abuse has not yet become become clear. But it has, you know, certainly in terms of the ability of people to get a sense of where the authority was being derived from. I certainly don't think that, for example, Mo, in your position, you would have had 70,000 applications come across your desk.
Sure. If I could come in on the 70,000, and I suspect that, and I know, and I have a general, I have a very good idea why that is the case. But let me just say, you know, our constitution, and the hint I'm going to give you, Kanthan, is this. Our constitution says South Africa belongs to all who live in it, both black and white.
Mm-hmm. And that was taken from the Freedom Charter.
Right, exactly. But it doesn't mean, and here's the important thing, if you live in South Africa, then you have certain rights. Yes. It doesn't mean that you are a South African who has certain rights. If you live in South Africa...
Oh, are we looking at people overseas?
No, if you take migrants who come into the country, right?
Okay.
Now, when they are in the country, and if they are living in the country, the interpretation of that clause means they have the same rights that South Africans have. And that matter is now being taken to court, right, where it is being debated. But okay, so does a person who's living in the country without authorization have the same rights as a South African? But that's the way it is written in the Constitution. It may not have been intended like that, but that's a determination the Constitutional Court would have to make. Now, in a very similar vein to that, there is the RICA, had a loophole in the law, which, subject to a different interpretation, would have meant that, yes, you could have intercept bulk interceptions without necessarily having to go through the process of the judicial process. And I think this loophole in the law allowed certain, and if you want to call it abuses, or allowed certain... prerogatives that the intelligence services exerted, and that is the one that is being debated, Parliament has to look at whether the interception capabilities must be subject to the checks and balances. Because in the main, your intercept technology is pulling data from out the sky, it's pulling data from sea cables. And you need to apply then the law, right? What happens to a criminal who has a South African cell phone number, but who's not South African, but who's using, because of routing or rerouting, does that person who has a South African number has the same right as a South African? These are the debates, and of course I'm not saying that.
I think we all accept that there are grey areas, but
and that most complexities.
Most people in this country are concerned for their privacy.
Yes,
what little of it remains.
Yeah, of course.
And the worst people usually to have that information are the government, because as we've seen, not particularly good at running state-owned enterprises, not particularly good at running. Even in the ANC, running the factions against each other just proves that sometimes people will be used as weapons, and people's lives can be ruined.
Yeah.
And that's no small matter.
Gareth, I agree with you. And I just want to say to Kanthan, that's the wonderful thing about our democracy, that because we have such a healthy NGO, vibrant NGOs in our country, they pick up these issues, and the pressure gets onto Parliament, the laws have to be re-looked at, and that's the greatness of South Africa's democracy. Lastly, on this matter, you do have, in a particular country, where there was an attempt to have an impeachment done. And you'll see that what happens, at least the Democrats believe, that Trump was needed to be impeached.
Right.
And they made a very compelling case, and that case did not happen because they were defeated by the political distribution of power in the U.S. But that's an
which example. Has been the case for every single impeachment prior to that.
Exactly.
As well.
Mm-hmm. Right. But we had the same issues in our own country. But this is the wonderful workings of democracy. So I agree with you. I also have been giving thought to what happens when there's too much of power, presidential power. Mm. It may not be the problem that we have too much of presidential power. The problem may be, can we hold the president accountable for the exercise of that power? And what would we do when the president abuses that power? Now, I, for one, I've identified this as a deficiency in the intelligence services, because the Constitution says the president has the power to direct the intelligence services. Well, the question then remained, what happens when the president misdirects the intelligence services? What are the checks and balances on that?
Are there controls in terms of parliament? I mean, there's a portfolio committee on intelligence.
Yes, there's a joint standing committee on intelligence.
How involved are they and do the intelligence services have a requirement to report to them regularly?
They have the power and the authority, so does the Inspector General. So we have all the great mechanisms. The question is this, whether the people who are in those positions of checks and balances, whether they've got the chutzpah to hold the executive and the intelligence services accountable.
And very often, and we saw this during the Zuma administration, a lot of those people are deployed cadres who do not have the inclination to argue against their own employment, essentially.
Yes, and I think that's the deficiency. Mm. And I think in the beginning, when we established the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, which was a parliamentary oversight, there were particular protocols given to that committee that rendered it somewhat different from other parliamentary committees. And for the first period, and for the period in which I was there in the early period, I found fantastic working relationships between ANC, they were then called the Democratic Party, the Nationalist Party, the IFP, and they held us, including I remember Tini Kroonewald from the Conservative Party, served on these committees, and they held the intelligence community to a very high standard. And I took great encouragement that will sustain. Unfortunately, it didn't turn out to be the case. And this speaks to the quality of people that political parties put on their list. If they're not putting very capable people who understand that when they are in parliament, what are their responsibilities? Their responsibilities is to the people of the country and not always and necessarily so to the political parties that put them there. Mm. That is the, for me, where I would call it hubris, where we started to see the decline in the quality of people in parliament, and then as a result, parliament not holding the national executive, and in this particular case, the intelligence services, accountable.
Do we have a lot of assets that we deploy? I mean, we talk about in the intelligence community that there are people who supply you with information,
yes,
internationally, locally. Do we have a large network who work for the intelligence services?
Yes. Let's just take an example. No secrets, but I hope that most South Africans reflect on the fact that at a time of heightened terrorism, nothing happened in the 2010 World Cup. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Thing, zero, nada. That just didn't happen. It was
everyone else was
very nervous. There was, I remember those reports that there are bases in Mozambique from which Al Qaeda is going to attack, etc. And the professors who wrote those things have kept very quiet during that period.
Also, give us some credit for the fact that one of the reasons why we've been able to evade that is because of the fact that we have not taken sides in any of those conflicts that have been playing themselves out around the world. And you know, I never
absolutely
thought that,
correct.
You know, so quoting Bin Laden. You know, who said at one point, if you say that we hate freedom, ask why we don't bomb Sweden.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of a relevant point. Not that I'm for a second justifying any of the stuff that these guys did.
Yeah.
But I think that the political line that we have taken since the dawn of our democracy has been very clear in terms of not actually wading in on the side of either conflict, except for the question of Israel versus Palestine, which I think we're particularly one-sided about because of historic allegiances that play themselves out to this day. But by and large, in terms of what happens on the ground, you know, irrespective of the political posturing that you see from the ANC as a party, that hasn't actually translated to what happens in terms of policy that gets practiced by the ANC in government. So I think that these are all things that most
are absolutely correct. It is the posture of the government through many of the conflicts that works in our favor. And in particular, at that time, in the Somalia conflict, right, where Al-Shabaab was the major protagonist and where we thought Al-Shabaab could be an element of disruption for the World Cup, it's because we took a very deliberate stand of not getting or deploying our forces in that conflict that Al-Shabaab did not attack us in South Africa. So, yes, it's the posture. It's a combination of other things. But I'm dying to tell you one thing. So, if they want to charge me, they can charge me for this.
Go on.
You would recall that in the World Cup, we had a volcano in Iceland.
Yes.
The most difficult name of that volcano.
Couldn't pronounce it.
It ended with a rich, right? And this volcano exploded and it erupted and there was this cloud of dust
and there was no air traffic and for some time
and it was happening at the time of the World Cup. So here's what the intelligence services did. We brought in a consulting engineering firm who would be able to tell us exactly the level of the volcanic ash in that cloud, whether planes could fly through it or not. And once we came to the conclusion that they will shut down the airspace because it was moving southward, the intelligence services came up with a plan to be able to bring people from Europe to the World Cup free of charge by sending SAA planes to appointed places. And we did the calculation that if we did that, and if we had to deploy those planes free of charge, the country will still benefit in respect of the cost. And that is what an intelligence service does when it looks at scenario
what happened
scenario
since that
planning.
Plan with SAA, because now they're in the toilet.
Oh, yeah. Well, we should have used SAA for that. And they wouldn't have been in the toilet. But I'm just saying that there are just remarkable capabilities of an intelligence services that has to think about things out the box when there are disruptions.
I know there are a lot of people who want to talk about current affairs, and the Burning Platform is mostly a place where we do that. This morning, I just couldn't help myself with Mo being here. And congratulations on the release of your book, The ANC Spy Bible. I found it was just too much to ask to not let me be a little bit self-indulgent and ask him all these questions. There are some stories that I think are probably worth reflecting on. I don't know if you saw this headline, but just yesterday, Capitec announcing that they've lost an absolute fortune. I'm going to give you the exact amount, 30-odd billion.
Yeah,
30-odd billion rand, which is terrifying because Capitec is one of the best performing businesses in South Africa over the last while. And I think for a lot of people, this indicates something to be very afraid of in the current economic climate, among other things. But Mo, thank you. Canton, thank you. There are stories in Mo's book about Nightingale, the former policeman who gave you secrets about the security establishment, someone who you say is still alive.
Yes, he's still alive.
And the betrayal of two presidents in a liberated South Africa, two people who let you down anyway, Thabo Mbeki and later Jacob Zuma. Do you still speak to these guys?
Yes, I still do.
Do you guys just put it all aside?
You know, that has been the case with President Mbeki. I found him to be incredibly mature, even when we had our disagreements.
Because you got to do what you got to do, whether you're president or,
exactly,
you know, Mo Sheikh.
the... I mean, I haven't received a call from President Zuma, but if I do, I will most probably take it.
He's
very ill, Mo. Cut him some slack, please.
Mo knows all about what these...
Just want to make a point, though, apropos of Capitec. Just understand that the fact that your share price has declined by 30 billion doesn't mean that the company is worth 30 billion less, because effectively the value at any given stage of companies that are listed is based on perception
and ultimately price earnings.
Yes, and right now we have a scenario where people have been looking for liquidity, and what that means is that as far as possible you try and dispose of assets at the price that happen to be going at any given stage, and because everyone is scrambling to actually get access to ready cash, you have had this pounding that has taken place on the world markets. But for those who can actually afford to do so, the pattern always across the course of history is that the correction happens. And when the correction happens and it rebounds, it always rebounds at a higher level. So,
you're basically saying if you have any liquidity, just hold on to that until it's hit the bottom and then invest.
Well, unless you have need for ready cash.
Sure, of course.
Panicking at this point right now is absurd, because there is no safe haven. Right now, absolutely nothing is going to work. Oil is at the lowest levels that it has been in something close to 30 years now. It's below $25 a barrel.
Right.
And, if you just think about the implications of oil being at the lowest possible levels, gold has taken a pounding. Got to say that Bitcoin's the only thing that's actually held up. It's still 26% up year on year.
Mo, I hope we can have you back again soon.
Be a pleasure.
Yeah, and Canton, thank you very much this morning. I'm sorry that I railroaded Mo's book to center stage, but it needed to be done.
There's How come you get a free copy? I'm gonna have to bum one off him as well.
I was an asset during the last 10 years. You never know. I'm being paid back with a book. Yeah. All right. Thank you all very much for joining us this morning. I'm afraid that's all we got time for. The Burning Platform, brought to you by Nando's this morning. I want to finish off with a quote that was provided to me by Morgan on the WhatsApp line, and it's something Benjamin Franklin once said: "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety."
Well, in that case, can I leave you with a quote as well?
Go on.
Which is, this is from Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who said, "Usurpers will always choose troubled times to enact, in the atmosphere of general panic, laws which the public would never adopt when passions were cool."
It's one of the Jean-Jacques Rousseau quotes I like.
Mm. Okay. All right. So can I add my one then?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, go for it.
Don't worry, be happy. Cliffcentral.com.